On our afternoon agenda, we're on item G, and before we hear from that, I'd like to make a few comments before we begin the public comment period. Item G, as you know, is the presentation of the report and recommendations of the Strategic Evaluation Committee, and we have the Honorable Judge Charles D. Wachob, Chair of the Strategic Evaluation Committee, present, as well as the Honorable Brian L. McKay, Vice Chair of the Strategic Evaluation Committee. But I begin this agenda item by expressing my deep gratitude to the Strategic Evaluation Committee, and I know many members are here today as well. The committee of judges, both sitting and retired, and the four executive advisory members, and especially Judge Charles Wachob and Assistant Presiding Judge of the Superior Court of California, Placer, and Judge Brian McKay, Presiding Judge of the Superior Court of Merced, the Chair and Vice Chair, all deserve our respect and admiration for taking on an unprecedented review of the AOC in order to recommend to us, the Judicial Council, the ways in which the AOC can be improved to best serve the interests of the judicial branch and the state as a whole in these grim fiscal times. The 14 judges and four advisors on the SEC served at my request without staff support and devoted countless hours to their evaluation of the AOC. And I thank you for your service. I know you've heard it from many members of council, but you have my formal gratitude for taking on this very big, tremendous task. Their 55 weeks of dedicated service to this task, I think, speaks volumes about the gravity with which the SEC approached their mission and the depth and scope of their mission. And what they've provided to the council, I think, is a very helpful tool that we will employ as we continue to move our branch forward and keep our focus on improving the branch despite a very, very challenging fiscal environment. When I became Chief Justice, it was and continues to be important, and I would say even urgent to me, to ensure that the council uses every tool available to assess the needs of the public, the judicial branch, and every court in our state system, so as to ensure that we are delivering on the promise of equal justice for all. So when I began, and even to this day, an informed, comprehensive look at the AOC was one of my first priorities. And over the last 15 years, those of us in the branch who experienced the transformative effect of state funding, trial court unification, and responsibilities for our court facilities, we knew that the Judicial Council had assumed greater duties, and the AOC had accordingly grown in responsibility, complexity, and size. But in 2011, in our third consecutive year of budget reductions, I felt we needed more information about whether or not the AOC was still operating effectively and efficiently, given the present circumstances and the Council's priorities. That's why I appointed the SEC in March 2011, just weeks after I was sworn in, and that was after I had enlisted the presiding judges to help me get a better overview through surveying all the trial judges in the state on branch governance issues. And the SEC was intended to provide a further mechanism to assist me and counsel to gather data, assess priorities, and to determine what changes might be made to improve AOC operations and efficiencies in order to best serve the courts and ultimately the public. Such a report has not previously been undertaken. And I think it reflects, among other things, our branch's historic willingness to take a hard look at ourselves, particularly as we work to conform to the current needs of the public and the branch, and in the midst of an unstable and grim financial reality over which we have little to no control. The Judicial Council has been and continues to be an enthusiastic leader of positive change. The AOC has been historically the instrument that we've relied on to implement the Council's vision and its steadfast priorities, that is, improving access and fairness for all Californians. You'll be hearing more from Jody about changes that have been made and are underway. And now with this report, we have an invaluable tool, and I'm confident that we will continue to reexamine our practices and the activities of the AOC to ensure that they're still right for our courts and our state in this changed and constantly changing environment. Lastly, I released this report in May as soon as I received it, and even before its presentation to the council, because of the great interest in it statewide, and so that we could all read it together, and so that council could start to gain insight into further reflections on the implementation of the report. And today the report will be formally presented to the council in the same way in which all critical reports are handled. And today will be an opportunity for us as council to hear from the SEC, to discuss the report, and to decide how we proceed. And as I look out, and based on my email and the letters I've received, I'm heartened to see such great interest in the subject, as is evidenced by all of you here today who are here to listen and comment, and those of you who have already submitted letters and emails offering your views. I want to say that it shouldn't come as a surprise to any of us that in our branch of trained critical thinkers, of judges and lawyers, court execs, that the report has generated intense dialogue, a number and stew of conflicting opinions, if you will, in the branch. But I look forward to a spirited dialogue conducted professionally and civilly as befits our branch and as a judge. I anticipate that it will help yield change for the better and advance and improve our ability, both the judicial councils and the branches as a whole, to provide equal access to justice. Once again, I thank the SEC members, including retired Presiding Administrative Justice Art Scotland, who started the work, former member of the SEC, and for all of your hard work. Later on, as you'll know, I've also asked Justice Miller, as chair of the council's Executive and Planning Committee, to recommend a process for the council taking action on the recommendations made in the report. And in the interest of time, and because I think based on all the comments and the discussions we'll have after the presentation of the report, I suggest that council discuss the report after hearing from both the chair and vice chair of the SEC, and then Justice Miller. But before we start that, we have many interested people who come to speak on the report. And I will call first upon our colleagues who have come here to speak to the report. And I'll start with Justice Lori Zelon from the California Court of Appeal, speaking on behalf of the California Commission on Access to Justice. And because G and H have been merged, you'll have 10 minutes to present your views. Thank you, Justice Zelon.
Thank you, Chief. And good afternoon, members of Council. Thank you for allowing me to come here today on behalf of the Commission on Access to Justice. I want to start by reiterating what we said in our letter, which is that we are very thankful for the very hard work and the thoughtful work that went into the presentation of this report. It is the Commission's hope that it can be helpful as the Council moves forward in its consideration of the recommendations and the policy decisions that have to be made, that we can provide whatever input Council would find helpful on the issues of access to justice that the Chief just spoke about. The ability of the Council to consider this is going to be, I hope, assisted by the comments of people who came here today. But there are many, many people who couldn't come here today and be before you, and I think it's important to have their voices heard as work goes forward. I start by saying on behalf of the Commission, and that is the position in which I'm hearing today, the report has very little focus on the significant and positive efforts of the AOC to carry out this council's policy in terms of ensuring access to justice in our courts. And that's the core of our function as a branch, of course. And it's where the work of the branch, the work of the council, overlaps with the work of the Commission on Access to Justice. So I hope today to talk about some of those issues. Just as background, I've been privileged to be involved with the Commission on Access to Justice since before it was formed. I was on the committee that looked into whether we should have one. And I was honored to serve as the first chair of the commission, and I continue in an adjunct role. The former chief said the commission was like Hotel California. You could get in, but you could never leave. And apparently that's true. The commission in California is a unique entity. Unlike many other states, it was not formed as an entity of the Supreme Court. It is an independent entity which has very broad membership from the public, from the legislature, from labor unions, from religious organizations. But from the beginning, from the very first moment, the commission partnered with this judicial council and with the AOC to carry out its work because of the mutual interest. And that partnership enabled very significant achievements in making our courts accessible to the people that we all are here to serve. Just a couple of examples to be specific. First, in language access. The Commission has issued a report on language access, and of course the courts are vitally interested in language access, more now than ever with the continuing interest of the Justice Department in language access as a civil right and their investigations of all the states in terms of what they're doing. Without the work of the AOC on interpreter standards and education and expanding the base of interpreters, the significant impact of the Commission's report and the recommendation to go forward could not have been carried out. The Commission could not do it by itself, and that partnership has enabled us to move forward in significant ways in providing access to people who do not speak English as their positive, as their first language. The second specific example is self-help. The self-help efforts in California really began with attendance at a national conference in Arizona, where members of the Commission and people from the AOC formed the team that went to Arizona to learn. From that came the statewide access plan. From that came the self-represented litigants task force. And today we have self-help centers in every court in California. The Commission was able to have input on the important guidelines which guide and regulate those centers. Those guidelines ensure quality, they ensure uniformity, and they ensure cost-effectiveness of the work of the self-help centers. And they make sure that it does not matter to the litigant whether they are in Sonoma County or San Diego County or Yolo County, that their standards by which self-help is provided will be the same. And these are enforced through the terms of the contracts which the AOC enters with each of the courts. And those contracts are an important way to make sure that justice is equal across the state of California. The Commission's role in this has been not only to support but also to do some work on unbundling. And when the Commission recommended that unbundling was a way to provide services to people who could use some help in self-representing, the AOC staff drafted forms and rules. Why is that important? The thing lawyers worry about in unbundling is that the judge won't let them out of the case when they're done. And these rules provide, and forms provide, a clear way for lawyers to get in and out, for the judge to know what needs to be done and when to let the lawyer out, and to make sure that litigants know what they're being represented on and what they're not. So this work in putting that together was incredibly important. Let me turn now to some specific issues about the recommendations themselves that we'd like to highlight. There were a number listed in the letter. I want to talk about two. One is a suggestion that limiting rules changes and forms changes to those required by statute or by a case law would seriously hinder the development of policies that serve litigants. The unbundling procedures I just talked about were not required by the legislature. They weren't required by a case. It was a case where the courts and the Commission working together saw a need to make access available to litigants in a new way and led the legislature. And that has happened time and time again, where the people on the ground recognize the problems well before the legislature does. And if we cannot act without the legislature telling us to, we will lose the opportunity to innovate and to protect those who come to our courts. By the way, these rules also improve courthouse efficiency. A judge can move a case much more quickly if on very difficult issues a party is represented. And we are beginning to see those efficiencies pay off as these rules are implemented. Another area where this worked was trial court delay reduction many years ago. That, too, most of the changes were not mandated by legislation, but led by the branch. The second area that I wish to express concern about on behalf of the Commission is the emphasis on business case analysis for new initiatives. The concept that our core function of access to justice should be subjected to a cost-benefit analysis based on financial terms strikes me as odd. Not that we do not want to increase efficiency and make our courts effective. Of course we do. But access sometimes requires upfront expenditures. For example, the self-help projects and the self-help centers require an infusion of cash to get them going and to get them operating. We are now beginning to understand, in real dollar terms, what that means in terms of savings to the court, in terms of hours in the courtroom and staff time. But at the beginning, there was no way of knowing that. And yet, it was the right thing to do because the litigants needed that assistance. And so I think when we think about how we are going to analyze business case, when we talk about access to justice, the driving force must be the needs of the litigants, and our focus must be the needs of the litigants, rather than some more abstract cost-benefit analysis. And so I would ask the council, as it considers how it wants to act on this very important report that is received, when and how to implement the recommendations, whether they need modification.
Justice Zeilan, you'll have one more minute.
All right, I'm finishing up. I would ask you, thank you, Chief, I would ask you to consider the needs of the litigants as the priority as we go forward as a branch. And I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Justice Zeilan. Next, Judge Steve White, Alliance of California Judges.
Good afternoon. Madam Chief Justice, members of the council, thank you very much for allowing me the 10 minutes today to talk with you about this extraordinary document, the Strategic Evaluation Committee report. To the Chief's considerable credit, the Strategic Evaluation Committee, under the leadership of Judge Wacob and Judge McCabe, along with nine other judges, achieved a most exceptional result, a truly remarkable document. One of the most significant contributions that the Chief made in making this happen was not only the initial decision to establish such a committee, but appointing to it judges of such integrity that they would do the kind of job that they did. I'm not sure that this would have happened before. One of the telling and epitomizing emblematic aspects of the report is the observation that the committee made that the Judicial Council is not at the top of any of the AOC org charts. This is not, of course, an accident. It happened because it was allowed to happen. The SEC's call for transparency, accountability, and efficiency and change in tone and attitude must be for this council an urgent priority. For too many years, the AOC has actively and aggressively usurped the power of the courts and has been, as the SEC has found, dishonest with regard to budgeting, staffing levels, pretend hiring freezes, major projects reflecting AOC priorities, and the list goes on. This happened because the Judicial Council let it happen. The docility and compliance of previous councils aggrandized the role and the powers of the AOC and the Chief Justice alike. All of this was possible only because the council was never democratically elected. It never represented the judiciary itself. I speak today for the Alliance of California Judges, for several hundred judges who know this all too well. Change must come. Actual representation will not occur until the council is elected by the judges of California and so is accountable to the judges of California instead of to a one-person appointing authority. Having many times addressed the council and having watched interactions between council members, I know that healthy debate and dissent have not been well received. I think that under the Chief Justice now is beginning to change. Healthy debate and dissent are cornerstones of both democracy and group decision-making. Many costly and harmful decisions which have brought great grief to our branch of government could have been avoided had there been healthy debate, had dissent been permissible, and had there been independent votes without fear of recrimination. The current system is broken and it needs mending. Democratizing the council, making it truly representative of the California judiciary, is fundamentally necessary. While the years of what was essentially one chief, 21 votes, may be over, the council will never be representative of the judicial branch until it, in fact, represents the judges of California. And representation, by definition, is an assignment conferred by those being represented. It is not imposed on those who would be represented. Though democratizing the council is critically necessary, our problems are urgent and cannot wait for that reform. For all concerned, change must start now and with you. For too many years, it has been far more about the will of the AOC and the appointing authority than about the responsibilities of an entire branch of government. Your responsibilities and my responsibilities and those of every judge in California. We are state constitutional officers obliged under the Constitution to run the judicial branch. We do not meet this obligation by delegating this burden to an untethered AOC, an AOC which prefers its own agenda over our commitment and responsibility to keep courts open for the people of California. And if you don't believe this is exactly what has happened, reread the SEC report and examine the AOC budgets and examine the budgets of the 58 trial courts and 6 appellate courts in the state. See where resources were cut. See where they were added. See where staff were cut. See where they were added. The entire judiciary is watching with great interest to see how the SEC proposals will be addressed by this body. Will they be adopted, endorsed, full speed ahead, made to happen? Or will we instead have more committees and more study? Will its opponents swallow chunks of it or simply nibble it to death? If this council is to regain its lost credibility, it must advance the SEC's recommendation at a sprinting pace. In that vein, the Alliance strongly supports Judge Lee Smalley Edmonds' proposal that the judges who produced this extraordinary SEC document be charged with tracking the progress of this undertaking. Now, after courts have been downsizing for more than 3 years, and at a time when courts are closing every week and court staff laid off daily, while the AOC grew and gave raises and enhanced benefits, the council must move without delay, to substantially downsize the administrative office of the courts so its entire function is core services to the courts, especially in the rural counties. And the freed-up resources must be redirected to keeping trial courts open. A sine qua non of access to justice is access to courts. Courts that are closed are inaccessible. The entire judiciary is watching, and I suspect the other two branches are as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge White. Next, we'll hear from Judge Brian Walsh, Assistant Presiding Judge, Santa Clara County.
Thank you, Chief. Chief Justice, members of the Judicial Council, AOC staff, and guests, I'm Brian Walsh. I'm here to speak on behalf of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, of which I'm the Assistant Presiding Judge. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you, and also thank you for the doing the difficult work of the Judicial Council and entering into the discussions and hard choices that you must make. I was on the Judicial Council as an attorney member for 4.5 years in the mid-90s. I know your pain, but we're here to discuss the SEC report, and our court certainly believes that every successful organization must be reevaluated from time to time. And for the AOC, now is the appropriate time. I've read the SEC report, and I want to compliment its authors and the committee for its valuable and thorough report. It contains some excellent ideas and recommendations, including greater clarity to budget reporting. Wouldn't it be great if we could follow last year's budget, compare it to this year's budget, and comparing apples to apples? Wonderful. It recommends downsizing and consolidating certain functions and divisions. It recommends that the AOC participate in absorbing some of the kinds of budget reductions that we in the trial courts must endure. But on behalf of our court, we urge that any downsizing, any consolidating, any budget cutting be done thoughtfully. The goal should not be simply downsizing, but right-sizing, so that the AOC organization that results from your decisions can properly fulfill its mission. The SEC report points out that many smaller courts benefit directly from AOC services, but I want to stress that our court, a larger court, benefits directly from AOC services. We just lost our general counsel. A phone call away was the general counsel's office from the AOC seamlessly stepping in to give us their help and their guidance and their legal work. The Office of Governmental Affairs in Sacramento often helps us work through the Byzantine hallways of Sacramento to work through our issues. The Office of Construction has been invaluable in helping us with the courthouse we're attempting to build in these difficult budget times that we badly need and that we could not succeed on getting without the talent that they provide, talent we could not get anywhere else. We need those services, but we agree with the SEC that those services must be provided with a service provider mentality and that the AOC staff must serve the trial courts, not run the trial courts. We also agree with the SEC recommendation 4-1, which states, quote, the Judicial Council must take an active role in overseeing and monitoring the AOC. We have no doubt that this council is doing so and that that active role will continue. But there are some who claim that the Judicial Council should simply, this Judicial Council that has failed its leadership role should then simply adopt the recommendations of the SEC in whole. That seems to me inconsistent. If you must adopt a leadership role, then by all means do it. And doing it, that means you must make the final decision. When I was on the Judicial Council, we had many important reports presented to us. The Race and Ethnic Bias Report, the report, Blue Ribbon Commission on Jury Improvement. Excellent people got together with thorough study and made wonderful recommendations, but we didn't just adopt it. We vetted each and every one of them. It became the Judicial Council's decision, not the Blue Ribbon Commission's decision. And that must be the case here.
Excuse me, Judge Walsh, you have 30 seconds.
Thank you. And finally, I urge that you do it quickly. I agree with those that the credibility of this entire project is not just in the quality of the decisions, but in making the decisions now, with all deliberate speed, not too much public input. You've had plenty of that. The decision is yours, and we urge you on behalf of our court to make it now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge Walsh. Next, we'll hear from Ms. Julie Safran on her own behalf, family law attorney.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm a family law and domestic violence attorney practicing in Santa Clara County, which ranks among one of the largest court systems in the state. I'm also a law school instructor, a member of CEDRA faculty, a mentor attorney to pro bono attorneys, a board member of a legal services agency, and a member of the Domestic Violence Council of Santa Clara County. It's from these combined perspectives that I see firsthand the tremendous contribution the AOC has and its programs have made, and I want to tell you how consistently I rely on their materials, their training, their support to our court's infrastructure, and to my practice, my teaching, and my training. The SEC report did not seem to accurately reflect the enormity of the positive contributions the AOC has made. I would not like to see these positive efforts cut or canceled without careful determination of the impact that would be made as a result of the cuts. I believe the view from the ground is that notwithstanding the acknowledged need for effective management and appropriate staffing sizes, the AOC's efforts are vital. The ways the AOC has improved the family court system in my county are incredibly important and substantial. The specific efforts that I experience in day-to-day practice include access to visitation grants for supervised visits, as well as the AOC's publication on non-professional supervision, which is a much-needed alternative. My county was an early participant in the CCPOR Protective Order Registry. This function is so much more than an IT function. It actually helps increase the safety of domestic violence victims because judges know who is standing in front of them when they have information about the restrained person. The availability of Justice Corps interns to assist pro pers in our clinics. I've presented at a Justice Corps training, and this is an important, leveraged, and cost-effective resource that instills in college students a mindset for public service in our courts. The AOC, especially the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts, provides a vast amount of self-help information for litigants, including domestic violence information translated into several languages. As an attorney where the other side is not represented, I appreciate that self-represented litigants can get the information they need to represent themselves in an effective manner, and this helps avoid costly delays in our courts. As an aside, as a law school faculty member, I think the availability of so much accurate self-help encourages new admittees to the bar to tackle family law as a practice area, and more family law attorneys in our courts is going to be a good thing for court operations and the administration of justice. The AOC supports our family law facilitators' offices, our child support commissioner, and the training of family court services mediators. All of these are vital functions that enable our courts to serve families without unnecessary delay and expense. Mediators and facilitators especially help these litigants reach agreement that keep these families from coming back to court time and again, and this is an efficiency. Finally, the AOC's training of judicial officers is crucial, especially in domestic violence matters, where the lack of judicial education about the nuances and complexities of domestic violence can actually be dangerous. CEDRA training programs tackle cutting-edge issues. I was privileged to be part of two CEDRA trainings that looked at the impact of emerging internet technologies in domestic violence matters. And the judges needed to understand how technologies can be used to abuse victims, the evidentiary problems that present with high-tech allegations, and risk assessment that may need to accompany these cases. I use AOC-developed materials on a regular basis. These are high-quality and accurate publications, bench guides on domestic violence, firearms, working with self-represented litigants. They all improve judicial consistency in these matters as they help make sense of complicated statutory schemes. The AOC's research arm scrutinized the effectiveness of California's batterers intervention programs in a multi-year, multi-county study. And the result was a substantial research publication that I have assigned to my law students and that informs the bench, the bar, and policymakers about this critical intervention to remediate domestic violence. I participate in invitations to comment on judicial counsel forms, and I'm very thankful that knowledgeable AOC attorneys are working on these forms updates, especially related to domestic violence, juvenile, and family law. The variety of the statutory schemes means that forms revision is extraordinarily complex, and I appreciate the involvement of the AOC. Their lawyers are incredibly skilled, and they have depths of experience in family law, procedure, domestic violence, self-help, education and training, and many other areas. The SEC report appeared to criticize the involvement of the AOC in the development and proliferation of forms, but neglected to mention how important accuracy and coherence of forms is and how challenging it is to get it right.
Excuse me, Ms. Safran, you'll have 30 seconds.
Thank you. I'm not commenting on the AOC's organization or structure or specifics of staffing, but to conclude, I hope that these recommendations will be viewed on a case-by-case basis and the importance of the functions will be considered before wholesale cuts are made. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Safran. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Paul Fries, Vice President, Public Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't suppose I could finagle 10 minutes?
Nope, denied.
Lawyer with a captive audience. For those of you not familiar with Public Counsel, we are the nation's largest provider of pro bono legal services. I'm here today to share our appreciation of and support for the leadership that the AOC has demonstrated with singular dynamic force in promoting specifically the collaborative court model. I did think I would, if you don't mind, I'd frame my discussion with a quick story, the moral of which is how the times have changed. My wife is a family physician who takes both of our sons, David and Leo, to a female family physician. And one day she was talking to David, he was about 4 or 5 years old, and she said, "So, David, what would you like to be when you grow up?" And he said, "I want to be a lawyer like Daddy." And she was kind of hurt. She said, "Don't you want to be a doctor like Mommy?" And he goes, "A male doctor? No." How the times have changed. In many ways for the better, but unfortunately, in many ways for the worse. When I grew up, I never saw a homeless person. The word homeless was not in my vocabulary. In 1970, a survey indicated that in the entire country, there are less than 25,000 homeless people. You may have all seen the most recent statistics that there are now triple that number in LA County alone. I've spent 18 years of public counsel searching out best practices to help prevent and alleviate the shameful spectacle of human suffering that is homelessness, and that empower vulnerable populations. And I have to say, the collaborative court model does more to break the cycle of homelessness and intractable poverty than any service delivery model I personally have witnessed. And the AOC has played an invaluable and dynamic role promoting this vital model. Specifically, the AOC recently convened a homelessness summit here in San Francisco, attended by more than 160 leaders among our judiciary, criminal justice system, and public interest community. In fact, the summit commenced with a stirring address by you, Your Honor, Chief Justice, in which you touted the role that California has played championing the collaborative court model. You made it clear that access to justice means ensuring that we don't enable those who don't belong in the criminal justice system from ending up there, the homeless, the mentally ill, our combat veterans returning with the trauma of war. The collaborative court model has emerged to prevent this fundamental and core injustice, and the AOC has played a critical leadership role. In fact, this conference was probably the most impactful I've had in terms of rallying all who attended to dedicate themselves more vigorously to prevent the grotesque injustice of our time, that namely, 20% of all persons incarcerated throughout the United States are there not because of any criminal animus to hurt, maim, rob, rape, or cheat or kill, but because they're traumatized with mental instability, addiction, post-traumatic stress disorder, or traumatic brain injury returning from the wars. For this population, incarceration only exacerbates their plight and ensures recidivism, whereas the collaborative court model recognizes that placing individuals with supportive housing and in rehabilitative settings breaks the cycle of their helplessness. The AOC Homeless Summit also promotes awareness of the economic efficiencies that collaborative courts achieve by engaging local housing and nonprofit service providers to partner with the courts. The courts benefit thereby from a free source of alternative sentencing options. This liberates the court to focus upon its core judicial business involving real crimes. The AOC Summit also gave practical information on ways to expand the collaborative courts without added expense, critical in this fiscal era. For example, one of the most powerful forms of collaborative courts emerging is our veteran treatment court model. This can be achieved simply if judges simply set up a separate docket for veterans already on their calendar and engage the local VA to help provide alternative sentencing options. Veterans prove to do better as a group, and by simply having a segregated calendar, we can effectively address their needs and keep them in the community without having to incarcerate them. And this was highlighted very effectively through the summit. Our local veteran justice treatment court, just run by Judge Manley, recently had this first graduation of 7 veterans, and the district attorney herself touted that this would be translated into savings to taxpayers of more than $3 million annually. The AOC Summit also raised awareness of another form of collaborative courts, homeless courts, and how dramatically they can alleviate the administrative burden on the court by eliminating vast numbers of quality of life offenses and engaging community partners to provide alternative sentencing options. I also had the privilege a number of years ago of seeing the great work of the AOC in promoting the collaborative court model in Los Angeles when they organized the Leadership Summit promoting this model. The summit, attended by nearly 200 judicial and political leaders, led to Santa Monica investing in its first collaborative court, empowering their local community homeless providers to provide alternative sentencing options designed to minimize exposure to jail for those afflicted with mental health and addictive disorders. I would ask that you consider the other specific projects the AOC is responsible for and its accomplishments. It assists local courts in identifying local, federal, and private funding. It assists local courts with local and statewide cost-benefit studies of collaborative courts. The AOC's drug court cost study was recognized by the Government Accountability Office for its rigorous standards. It showed the processing in drug courts cost the same as traditional case processing with reduced recidivism and outcome costs.
Excuse me, Mr. Freeze, you have 30 seconds.
Okay. Since the committee began, collaborative courts have grown from less than 100 in California to in a handful of jurisdictions to more than 400 in all but 2 jurisdictions, serving about 40,000 cases a year. And to conclude, those of you who know me, I'm more likely to quote Jimmy Buffett than Warren Buffett. But Warren Buffett said something very profound. He said that his success was not attributable to any investment strategy, but rather by investing in good people. The AOC impresses me as having some of the most forward-thinking, visionary, dynamic individuals dedicated to shaping the administrative justice and access to justice for the 21st century. And while I understand this economy constrains us all to consider cuts and reorganization, I urge you not to take any action that would weaken or disrupt their leadership or the vital role they're playing in helping promote the collaborative court model with such singular effectiveness and force. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fries. We'll hear next from Mr. Anthony Pico, Commissioner on the Blue Ribbon Commission on Children in Foster Care.
Thank you, esteemed members of the council. My name is Anthony Pico. I am 23 years old, a student at Loyola Marymount University, trying to finish an undergraduate degree. I've spent over a quarter of my life, my entire adult life, as a commissioner on the Blue Ribbon Commission on Children in Foster Care, and I have seen our state make strides. We have gone from having, we still have roughly one-fifth of the nation's population of foster youth in our state, but we've gone from having roughly 80,000 to around 60,000 in my time on the commission. Reading the report makes me extremely sad, though, because it doesn't show those strengths that we have in our state and in the AOC. Over the years, I've spent a lot of time thinking about how we can improve justice. I didn't know I had a lawyer until I was 15. I was born in the foster care system. The work that is done with our experts that are staffing the AOC is invaluable. We have people that are sought after nationwide for their knowledge, for their time in the field. I fear that the report is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There's ways of maintaining our expertise and our values without having to increase funding. There's ways that we can address the issues that the public see. I worked in the legislature for 4 years, so I'm well aware of the budgetary restraints that we are facing. But I'm here to say, you know, as a foster youth, I have emancipated, and there's a high likelihood of me reentering the justice system at some point. And I plan to, as a lawyer and not as a defendant. And it's because of the lawyers that I interacted with at the AOC. I've worked across the country on improving foster care, and I can attribute that to watching, as a young teenager, lawyers who tirelessly sacrifice their time, their energy, to improve the courts. They have a passion. Yes, there are broken systems. Yes, there is fat that can be cut. But to say that we have a full-on abuse of the system, I feel that that's overreaching. The CFCC has literally become my family. When people died in front of me that were my caretakers, they stepped in, sacrificing their time, ensuring that their work was still done, but making sure that a member of the community, a client of their system, was being provided services, was at the top of their agenda. Now, I can't speak to the entirety of the report because it is so long and intricate, and there are definitely things that should be done from that report, but I should say you need to go through and examine wholeheartedly, because, yes, we can go back to 1992 standards, but do we want to? Do we want to go backwards in time and see ourselves facing the issues that we were fighting in the 80s and the 90s? I go to a university whose in its mission is the pursuit of justice. I hope that with this, we do have to make drastic cuts. We have to make the hard decisions. But we need to do it in a thoughtful and meticulous manner. The services that are offered, I have seen time and time again, are necessary. I don't want to see the state turn into north versus south, urban versus rural. I don't want to hear in 10 years, if I become an attorney, well, you should really practice in X county. They have a lot of great services. You really don't want to practice over in this other county. We shouldn't have 58 separate institutions. under one branch. We should have one institution united. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Pico. You are wise beyond your years. Thank you for that moving presentation. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Mark Wasak, attorney with Wasak, Hilly, and Fullerton. And I'm sorry if I may have mispronounced that.
No, Your Honor, you did it very well.
Thank you.
And Mr. Pico is always a difficult act to follow.
Yeah.
My name is Mark Wasak, and along with my two law partners for the past 10 years, I've represented parents and children in the San Francisco County Juvenile Dependency System. For the past 2 years, we've also represented the minors of Marin County, and it's in our work in Marin County where we've come in contact with our slice of the AOC in the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts through their DRAFT program. And although CFCC and DRAFT in particular didn't appear to be primary targets of the criticism in the SCC report, I wanted to relate to you our experience in dealing with CFCC. Now, I should point out that for the most part, in the work that we do, we're not shapers of policy like many people who are here today. We're really more foot soldiers who are interacting with clients, individual clients or groups of clients on a daily basis. Therefore, our observations are going to be decidedly more anecdotal. When we were selected to provide the representation in Marin County, we really didn't know what kind of support we would get through the DRAFT program. It soon became apparent because we were contacted by our liaison attorney who was assigned to supervise dependency representation in Marin County and other counties for which she was responsible. And our experience with a CFCC in Marin has been extremely positive and has been very beneficial to the jobs that we do. Besides regular and ongoing access in person, on the phone, by email with our liaison attorney, I'd just like to talk about three specific interactions with CFCC that have been beneficial. The first is that the CFCC facilitates our participation in the local Marin County Blue Ribbon Committee on Children in Foster Care. And this has resulted in active participation in developing new initiatives in Marin County that heretofore did not exist. For example, we've developed a peer parent mentor program, which pairs up parents who are going through the juvenile dependency system and helps them navigate a very difficult process to get their children back. There's a development of a program of early intervention team to get involved in cases early and perhaps prevent filing of juvenile dependency petitions at all. And there's been a countywide review and revision of local visitation guidelines for our the parent clients and their children. And these are all things that I don't think would have moved along at all or as quickly as without the involvement of our CFCC liaison. Secondly, our involvement with CFCC has led to greater interaction with various stakeholders throughout other counties in the juvenile dependency system. And this has led to us, for example, providing special immigrant juvenile status training to bench officers and social workers and attorneys in Stanislaus County. And upcoming, we are going to be involved with consulting and training of dependency practitioners in Del Norte County. And this is all coming from our involvement with the DRAFT program. And finally, one of the things the CFCC does particularly well is rolling out and coordinated comprehensive trainings across the state on existing law and new legislation that's coming online that affects how we provide legal services to our clients. And a prime example, recent example of this, is the massive and coordinated effort to educate and train multiple stakeholders in the sweeping changes brought by AB 12, which will extend services to dependent minors when they become 18 and give them the option to remain in the system receiving services as non-minor dependents. We're passionate about our work and our clients, and we're deeply committed to providing effective and zealous representation. Our involvement with CFCC in Marin has furthered those goals, and we have seen them as a beneficial partner in doing our work. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Wasak. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Christopher Dolan, attorney, on his own behalf. Before you start, Mr. Dolan, and I start your five-minute clock, I want to thank you for bringing to the President our letter chronicling the difficulties that the judicial branch is facing with funding that is like many other states nationwide. I appreciate your conveying that on our behalf. Thank you.
Before my 5 minutes, the President was in shock that there are no court reporters in our courtrooms, and as a constitutional scholar, he made a personal note on his paper to the fact that there were no court reporters. So the President heard your message, and thank you for allowing me to deliver it.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan.
First, my name is Christopher Dolan. I'm an attorney. I'm a plaintiff's lawyer. I'm a trial lawyer. My clients need the trial courts like they need air. But before I begin, I want to say to Mr. Pico, I met him in an airport 10 years ago. He was probably not even in high school. We spent a half an hour chatting on the bench about how to make a difference in the law, in the world, and we talked about law. And I just want to tell him, you need a job? My office. Any day. Okay. So I have to make the disclaimer. I'm not here on behalf of any organization, though I am the past president of the Consumer Attorneys of California and on the executive board of the San Francisco Trial Lawyers Association. It was so long ago I met him, I didn't need these glasses. I want you to know that I've served on numerous AOC committees, on core committees, and I've read the entire report and every comment that was given. And I needed several cups of coffee, but I think it is a valuable report. It was extensive, and insofar as it can provide more money to the trial courts, I'm all for it. As it relates to its main message that I heard, it was reorganization in service to the branch. But there's another element that needs the service, too. It's the ultimate person, the ultimate consumer. It's my client. When I leave here, I go to meet with a wife and two children whose husband was killed in a car accident 2 days ago. And I have to tell them about the delays in our court process that will probably mean that their case will not be heard for 3.5 years while they lose their home. This is the reality of what we're dealing with. So please keep in mind those consumers, and not just this issue between the branch, the AOC, the Judicial Council. There are some very valuable services. I'm not here to carry the AOC's water, but they're very valuable services that come out of it that are not in the report. I sit on the Civil and Small Claims Working Group. I sit on a Court Efficiencies Group. I sit on budgetary and financial groups, and somehow I manage to practice law, too. And I want to tell you about a service that the AOC provides that's not in that report. $100-some million to the judiciary over the past 4 years. How do I know this? I was in those negotiations regarding fee increases and other items that led to money coming from my clients and myself as a commitment to this court system to help backfill. The money that's in SB 1407, that's $247 million, it's part of the gap, came from a fee increase in the filing fees. I pay those filing fees on behalf of my clients. That money is now available to backfill. That came from a meeting in the AOC in this building down that hall, and I think it's called the Redwood Room. And if it isn't, then I'm mistaken. But I spent so much time in that room trying to hammer out a fee increase plan that provides access for justice. Kurt Childs and I have been on the phone with other members of organizations who are the leadership trying to hammer out a package. Ideas that he and I discussed 2 years ago are now coming to fruition to bring millions to the table. That's because the AOC is here. On the Court Efficiencies Committee, I just have you look at what the AOC does. Items A1 through A2, jury instructions. Statewide jury instructions are invaluable so that the appellate courts don't get logged down with different types of arguments. That's an efficiency issue. That's before you today. That came out of the AOC from lawyers like myself and Edith Mathai, who sit down with an unlikely group of allies called the Chamber of Commerce for us and the tort reformers. We sit in a room with them, and the only person who puts us in that room is the AOC. and we talk civilly, and we come up with plans that we work together with to accomplish the joint mission that we have. E-discovery, that has been worked out to keep people out of in front of courts and having to have motions to compel. Court call, that brought money. That court call came out of the Consumer Attorneys of California and the Defense Council sitting down and talking about how can we be more efficient and how can we bring some money to the council. The whole idea of jury reform, one day, one jury, came from meetings in the AOC. The preservation of voir dire, all of that came from meetings with the AOC. So, yes, you can look at this about how can we save money? How can we trim lawyers? If there weren't lawyers in those meetings, nothing would have happened. I can't talk to a paralegal about a legal process that they've never been involved in. I just can't. And I got to tell you, we're here to work day and night. I sacrifice my practice. I have a home in Sacramento to try to make this thing work because I spend so much time there. Judge White gives me a hard time because my lawn was a mess, but now I've cleaned it up. What I want to say is that yes, there needs to be a voice. There needs to be more transparency. But as somebody who practices in local courts, the AOC in this council is the only place within which there is that voice. There is no requirement that the local courts have open meetings. The only place we can make that change is here. In closing, I would like to say that item 6-8, the recommendation, a better process to assess the fiscal and operational impacts of proposed rule changes. Amen. Do it here. Take the report, but do exactly what's in the report, which is assess not only what the immediate changes are, but what the multiplier effect is of those changes as it causes inefficiency throughout the branch and our inability to come together to help keep this ship afloat. I thank you for your time and all of the work that you do.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan. While this ends our public comment period, I urge you, if you've not already done so, to go to our website and look at the written comments that we've received, approximately 15 letters and maybe more that still came in this morning that haven't been added to the written comment agenda. Very thoughtful letters, like the thoughtful public comment we received today, posted on our website, reviewed by all counsel. At this time, I'd like to ask the chair and vice chair of the SEC to please formally present the report to council. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief, members of the council. I'm Charles Walkup. I'm the current chair of the SEC. Next to me, to my right, is the vice chair, Brian McCabe, judge of the Superior Court in Merced. I was thinking here that it wasn't that long ago that SEC wasn't in everybody's lexicon. SEC used to bring to mind the Southeastern Conference or maybe the Security and Exchange Commission, but that's forever changed. As recognized in the report, the AOC has played a vital role in achieving monumental changes in the state court funding, trial court unification, and other efforts to strengthen the judicial branch and to make it a truly independent branch of government. Also, as recognized in the SEC report, the AOC is an essential organization because it fulfills a variety of functions, many of which are mandated by state statute, rule of court, or judicial council directive. However, the charge given to the SEC by the Chief Justice when she formed our committee was not to detail or list all of the many positive contributions of the AOC, of which there are numerous, but at the request of the Chief to undertake an in-depth, comprehensive examination of the role, functions, organizational structure, methods of operation, and staffing of the Administrative Office of the Courts, and to make recommendations to ensure that the AOC performs only essential functions in an appropriate, beneficial, cost-effective, and transparent manner. Accordingly, the SEC's report, by its very nature, focuses on problems rather than on many of the positives that we see from the AOC. At the outset, the SEC wishes to acknowledge that the AOC employs many dedicated, skilled employees. And that was acknowledged on the very first page of the report. It may be glossed over, but on behalf of the committee, I'd like to restate that. I don't intend to cover all of the findings and recommendations in the report. I'm sure you're glad about that. Many of you have read the report. It speaks for itself in many ways. What I would like to do is talk to you about the process. It's not discussed in the report specifically, how we went about our work, what we did, how we came together as a group of judges to make the recommendations and findings that we're presenting to you here today. First, the committee comes from all parts of the state and with incredibly diverse backgrounds, from the largest court literally to the smallest court, and with incredibly different perspectives. This committee was dedicated and spent many long nights, weekends, and hours away from their families and from their courts. I'm sure that many of the courts of that were involved here will be happy to get their judges back. I know that I'm looking forward to returning to my day job as a trial court judge. The thing that I would like to do, too, at this point is talk about the members of the committee, just briefly to acknowledge them, but also to demonstrate to you the diversity of background and perspectives that were brought to this task. First of all, the Chief Appointed Justice Art Scotland, former Administrative Presiding Judge of the Third District Court of Appeal, to be the chair of our committee, and he served probably through about three-quarters of our work until about February when he stepped down. He had incredible experience both on the trial court level and on the appellate court level. I think that I can speak for all of the committee members and specifically for myself. I was sorry when he stepped down. I was made chair. That was not something I envisioned when we started, but we all took up the work, and Judge McCabe stepped in as vice chair. Judge McCabe, if you will note in the report, there are numerous exhibits and attachments to the back. All of those charts and diagrams were the product of Judge McCabe's work. Those were not charts, numbers, and statistics that were pulled from an AOC shelf. We fought for those numbers, we dug for those numbers, and they were assembled. And that, I think, speaks to the diligence of our committee in trying to get to the bottom of some of the issues that we were looking at as we moved along. Also on our committee was Judge Verna Adams of the Marin County Superior Court. I don't know if she's here. She can wave her hand. There you go. Judge Adams was a trial judge for over 13 years, including a stint as the presiding judge of the Marin County Superior Court. She presided over the court's first domestic violence court and mental health court. When I asked her what she was most proud of as a judge, she told me that the thing that made her most proud was that she was a pioneer in establishing family law ADR. She set up the first interdisciplinary settlement conference program in the state for high-conflict custody cases in which volunteer mental health professionals are included as part of the settlement process, with astoundingly successful results. Also in our group is Judge Angela Bradstreet of the Superior Court of San Francisco, back there. This was part of the brilliance, I think, of the Chief Justice in appointing members of our committee that came from backgrounds with long experience as judges and shorter experiences as judges. Judge Bradstreet became a judge in 2010, but before that she was the former president of the California Women Lawyers and the San Francisco Bar Association. She was honored with the State Bar's Diversity Award, awarded to only one attorney each year, for work advancing women and gays and lesbians in the legal profession. Additionally, she brought to our committee 3 years as a state labor commissioner, overseeing an organization with approximately 400 people located in 20 offices. Judge Judy Cherlin, who is not able to be here today, is a retired L.A. County Superior Court judge with over 24 years on the bench. Her list of committees and involvement in the judicial branch is too long to detail, She has served on several Judicial Council special task forces, a member of CJR, and interestingly, for over 20 years, she taught legal issues in judicial administration at the Judicial Administration Program at USC. Judge Ron Christensen is the presiding judge of San Bernardino Superior Court. He's here. He had over 18 years on the bench and...
You're doing something funny.
And came to our committee with background as a former prosecutor and city attorney. Judge Cheryl Ellsworth, now seated, and I'm glad about that, seated at the table here to my left, is the current presiding judge of the Riverside Superior Court, has served on numerous Judicial Council advisory committees, task force, work groups, et cetera, concerning areas including domestic violence and family law. Also on our group, we do have people, in addition to Judge Justice Scotland, who have served on the Judicial Council, one of whom is Judge Suzanne Kingsbury, currently the presiding judge of El Dorado County Superior Court. She was a Judicial Council member from 2004 to 2007. She chaired the Rules and Projects Committee for 2 years. She was on the Trial Court Presiding Judge Advisory Committee since 1999. I asked her how many committees and work groups she's been on, and she said zillions, and I don't have any reason to doubt her. Not here today due to prior planned vacation is Judge Bill McLaughlin from the L.A. Superior Court, a longtime sage hand in the judicial branch, was on the L.A. Superior Court for over 20 years, served on numerous Judicial Council committees, was on the Judicial Council itself for several years, I think in around 2002 or so, and brought a perspective of someone who served on a large court. Moving from the largest court to the smallest court, bringing a small court perspective, Judge William Pangman, retired judge of the Sierra County Superior Court, served as a trial judge for over 14 years on that court, also served on a variety of Judicial Council committees, including the Trial Court Presiding Judge Executive Committee, and several terms on the Budget Working Group. Also here and a member of the committee is Judge Richard Tsuyoshi of the Sacramento Superior Court. Judge Tsuyoshi came from a civil litigation background, brought the perspective, as did Judge Bradstreet, of a new judge, someone that was not tied into the system particularly for a long time. I've been on a number of committees with other judges, and I have to say I was honored personally to serve on this group. It was an incredibly hardworking, diligent group. Our committee was also assisted by a pretty amazing group of advisory committee members. And this is not detailed in the report, but it's important to understand because I think it gives weight to our report. Jim Tilton, who is here today, had 32 years of experience working in a variety of positions with the state of California, including 28 years in executive management positions, including overseeing the state of California Department of Corrections, which employed at that time more than 55,000 peace officers and other staff members who worked in the prisons. And he has a background with the Department of Finance, as did all of our advisory committee members. So when we talk about recommendations about the budget process, it's a pretty solid group to be talking to. They know their stuff. Not here today is Diane Cummins, a longtime state government veteran, also a veteran in the Department of Finance, has served multiple governors and administrations. Dave Caffrey also is not here, served with several governors, cabinet positions, also has a Department of Finance background, and when he was done with his career in government, became a management consultant. All of those types of experiences helped our committee with the analysis of the organization that we undertook. Not here today also is Mary McQueen, who is an advisory member of our committee. She is the current president of the National Center for State Courts. She brought a perspective of other states. What do they do in terms of their judicial administration? And additionally, she had the experience of having been a director of the Washington State Court System. So I point that out not to brag about my committee members, but to try to highlight the diversity of their experience and knowledge that they brought to this task. In other words, this was a reasonable cross-section of judges in our state, and we were well-served by some very experienced advisory members. I can attest to the fact that our group came to the task with no hidden agendas, no preconceived notions, but only the promise to be objective, fair, and hardworking. First slide up. Oh, you got it. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about what our task was and what it wasn't, because if you read and listen to comments, I sort of get the impression that not everyone understands precisely what it was we were to do. We started with the charge that was given to us by the Chief Justice when the committee was formed back in 2011. The Chief Justice asked the committee to conduct an in-depth review of the administrative office of the courts and its organizational structure to promote transparency, accountability, and efficiency in providing services to the courts, and to make findings and recommendations to improve the efficiency of the courts and the AOC. Now, what is the report not? Somewhere along the line in the last year, the chief was quoted as saying that the SEC report was going to be the Bible. Thanks for not creating too great of an expectation, Chief. It is not. Nor is the report a formal audit. It is not that. Nor is the report a classic statistical or quantitative analysis of data that we collected. The report itself indicates in the introductory part some limitations that we faced as a committee in approaching our task. We were not provided resources other than the consultants and experienced advisory committees that we had with us. We were not asked to conduct employee workload studies, extensive fiscal analysis, job classification studies, or other types of studies like that. Although our report recommends that those occur. Those are necessary, but that was beyond our charge. The information that we received also was, at least from the AOC, was self-reported information. I want to talk about the timing of the report because I think you're entitled to know how we went about our report in terms of our own deadline and what happened to that. First of all, our committee received a two-year assignment. The committee was formed at the end of March 2011. We had our first meeting in May of 2011. I think someone anticipated that this was going to take a while, including up to 2 years. We were not, however, given a deadline by the chief nor anyone else. There was no external deadline. Our deadline was our own. You have to remember that the judges on our committee were working in the courts. They had day jobs. And the advisory committee members, several of whom were retired, were able to help a lot, but some were also not retired. So we had to work with that. I would like to dispel a rumor that there was some type of an interim report. There is one report. It is the report that you have. It was the one that was delivered to the chief at the end of May of this year. We had our last full committee meeting on May 9th, 2012, our report was issued several weeks after that. We continued to do interviews, including that of the finance director of the AOC, up to the last week before our report was completed. Some have suggested that we held our report until after the May revise budget appeared. That would be an utter coincidence. Our report was turned in when we completed it. Some have suggested that we turned in the report before the state budget was acted on to somehow influence the budget. That is also not correct. The report was given to the chief on May 24th, I suggested, which happened to be before the long weekend, and my suggestion to the chief was this report needs to be made public. It's going to be public. Let's get it out there. Let's start the comments on that. We need transparency. That's one of the themes of the report. Here's your chance. And the chief immediately put it out there. So as a committee, we think it was unfair that she was criticized for releasing the report when it was released. That's just when it was done. I want to talk a little bit about the context in which this report began, because we didn't spend time on this in the report. necessarily. The introduction to the report talks about the broader historical context in which the AOC developed and how it grew, some of the monumental legislative and other changes that happened, such as trial court unification, taking over court employees, taking over court facilities, and the like. The triggering event, as we all know, probably for this report, was dissatisfaction and unrest in the branch with the handling of the CCMS project. That's what brought things to a boil. We state that in the report. So when the chief came along in 2011 and asked us only several months into her tenure as Chief Justice to perform this task, what was the environment? What was it like when we were there? The chief made mention of it in her opening remarks. She said that she had sent out questionnaires to the presiding judges. The chief posed two questions to the Trial Court Presiding Judge Advisory Committee in March 2011, before our committee had had its first meeting, and it asked two questions. One, in your opinion, what, if any, are the specific problems with the operation of the AOC? And second, if you identified any problems, what do you recommend in terms of specific solutions to those problems? So those questions were asked, and those questions were answered before our committee met. To those questions, the chief received 108 pages of responses, which was the first material we were given as a committee when we set about our work. The responses are interesting because before our committee started, all of the themes and issues virtually that are reported in the report are referred to or mentioned or implicated in the answers that were given to the chief in those responses. Our report identifies several overarching themes. One, that the AOC is a top-heavy organization. Two, that the AOC internal management systems were deficient in various ways that are outlined in the report. Another overarching theme was that the AOC is oversized and should be downsized. Another overarching theme was that the focus on service by the AOC to the courts was losing out to a culture of control. And finally, another overarching theme that we identified in our work, which was also reflected in the preliminary responses that we received before we even started as a committee, was that the AOC needed to take steps to restore its credibility. A lot of those themes and concerns that were presented to us in that packet of information were concerns and issues that were present in this branch for a long time, but they were masked or not seen because at that time the judicial branch was more financially stable. The lack of financial stability and issues such as CCMS brought to a head the need to take a look at the AOC and how it operates. The questions that we sent to hundreds of trial judges and other persons in the state as part of our work, we told those folks those are your confidential responses. But what I will do is share with you the responses that were given to the chief before we started our work, because it set the groundwork for what we later did, and they mirror, to a large extent, the concerns that were expressed in the course of 1 year work that our committee did. There were many favorable comments to the AOC from the presiding judges and the comments they collected from their courts. There were comments to the effect that small courts need services. That was a theme that was identified frequently. That's mentioned in our report. Many people felt there were no problems at all with the AOC. Those comments were reflected. And there were specific comments about various of the very successful programs in AOC, including CEJR. The theme about performing essential functions was also reflected in some of the answers and comments that were given to the chief by various trial court judges, such as that the AOC has gotten out of hand, there's too many people, there should be a better definition of what the AOC is doing. The AOC appears to be performing non-essential functions. Many persons commented on the fact that they felt the AOC was top-heavy, that it had too many layers of management, and that there was a lack of accountability because of that. Many people commented and had the perception, and I'm going to talk about how we pierced this perception, many people had the perception that the AOC was oversized, citing the growth over a 10-year period and the fact that the AOC expanded at a rapid rate when trial courts were struggling with their budgets, similar to some of the comments that you heard here already today. Another theme that was identified in these early comments and an issue that was festering and present for a long time is the whole issue of whether or not the AOC is a service agent or a control agent. One person stated, as the chief so artfully stated recently, the AOC is not a control agency, but one could sure not tell that from the trial court level. The AOC needs to be trimmed, and the new Bill Vickrey needs to understand that the AOC works for the courts and not the other way around. These are the types of comments that we received. This ultimately formed one of the themes that we were trying to look at during the course of our work. Other issues also surfaced at that point regarding the restoration of credibility. Many people did not trust the AOC. They did not trust certain aspects of the operations. They didn't like the culture. Because our committee was asked to do a top-to-bottom review of the AOC, that necessarily included a look at the AOC divisions. Many people in the judicial branch commented about various criticisms they had on specific AOC divisions, including people that worked within the system, such as the comment that is on the screen in front of you, people that worked on advisory committees that had comments regarding their experiences with the AOC. In the course of our work, the SEC did not single out any particular division, but there were divisions that raised more concerns than others. Those comments are reflected in some of the comments regarding the Office of General Counsel. There was questions about how many offices they had, how many people that were working there, and whether or not there were conflicts in representations, and a number of specific problems. There were problems or comments that were raised regarding divisions in the AOC that are popular, such as CFCC. Several speakers spoke here before we talked, and to the uninitiated, to those judges that came to the committee without prior experience with CFCC, that was an eye-opener. And so the point I'm making here is that we came to the task with an open eye, trying to find out what the criticisms and concerns were, whether or not they were popular, whether or not the division was popular, made no difference. Our task, our charge, was to take a look at the organizational structure, efficiency, and transparency of the various parts of the AOC. The criticism was not spared. The SEC also received criticism. Move that. Some of the comments that were received said that the creation of a strategic evaluation committee staffed by the same AOC loyalists who serve on other judicial council committees and task forces is nothing more than a public relations gambit regarding the budget. So we want you to know that the SEC has taken its share of pot shots, just like you all do in your important work here on the judicial council. I don't know what it means to be considered an AOC loyalist or not, but I can vouch for our committee. Everyone on there is a judicial branch loyalist who came to this task with passion and dedication to try to make the AOC a leaner, more nimble, more effective organization so that the branch itself can succeed in its core mission of providing access to justice for people who need to get to the courtrooms and resolve the types of disputes such as Mr. Dolan just talked about before I spoke. I want to talk just very briefly, too, about the process that we use, because this was not talked about in the report. Our guiding principles when we evaluated information was to be objective, inclusive, thorough, and fair. We hope that that surfaced when you read the report. We decided at the beginning what our methodology was going to be, which was to gather as much information as possible. and to verify as much information as possible. In the course of our work, we sent out surveys or questionnaires to every sitting judge or judicial officer in the state, both appellate and trial court level, past judges. We felt that we owed a special obligation to court executive officers. Our committee did not include a court executive officer. We made special care and attention to reach out to the court executive officers because they're on the front lines of the relationships between the trial courts and the AOC, and they deal with the problems on a day-to-day basis, whereas many of the judges do not. We set about discovering information, analyzing the information, and preparing the report. I want to tell you that the information that we received was voluminous. We talked to anybody and everybody who had something to say about the AOC. When we heard something, that didn't mean it was true, but it meant that it was considered. Some people have asked about the way in which the SEC came about with its recommendations and findings. How did you get a room of a dozen or so judges to reach decision on anything? It's a fair question. And I just have to say, it was incredibly simple because the information that we received was so powerful and so consistent and so voluminous that it could not be ignored. Our committee, the entire committee, interviewed the former director, Bill Vickery, Ron Overholt, and as a committee, we interviewed each and every division director. That was followed up with written requests. It was followed up with more emails and requests for information than the AOC probably ever thought it would get. We know we were a pest, but we felt that we had to be thorough and diligent in our information finding. We interviewed as many court CEOs as we could. We broke up into groups of three. We talked to CEOs and presiding judges together. And what I have to say about the interviews is this. They were incredibly candid. Many people expressed that they had been wanting someone to tell their concerns to for a long time in a safe way, where there would be no possibility of any retribution or financial consequences to their courts or whatever. It was almost like a confessional at some point. But they were very, very candid conversations. The conversations often ended with the request that we not divulge their comments to anybody and with assurances of confidentiality. I think one of the strong suits of the report is the objective and thorough manner in which the judges on this committee and the advisory members sifted through the information to find out not only what the themes were, but what was the verifiable information. What I have said before is that any reasonable cross-section of a dozen judges in California, when confronted with the same information that we were given from all of the multiple sources of information that we derived, would have come to probably 95% of the same recommendations and findings that we did. It was not the members of the committee that were speaking. It was the information that was speaking. It was the judicial branch speaking. There were questions, I've heard it here today, about the tone of the report. And I would like to say that I believe, based on the information that we have, that the tone was completely appropriate. When you are looking at problems, when you are looking at personnel rules that are ignored, efficient management systems, which we outlined in the report, and various problems that we saw, they had to be discussed. Sometimes there's just not a really pleasant, nice way talk about those other than to identify them and say that there are problems. I can say, too, that the tone of the report could have been much harsher, but it wasn't. At the end of the day, we felt that the report was a judicious, fair, reasonable assessment of the information that we were provided. I want to talk too, because it's not, it's only given lip service in the report. I want to talk about the difficulty in getting information. You would expect that any organization, not just this one, that is being investigated or examined, would have some reluctance, some resistance to providing information. That would be a normal thing in a management review. That would be expected, and we encountered that. Our report, if you will notice, never made a conclusion that the information was withheld intentionally or to obfuscate or to derail us. But the information that we received was the result of a lot of digging, a lot of requests. The interviews with the division directors and the managers of the AOC, some were very candid, some were very helpful, some were very forthcoming, and some were not. Just flat out were not. And that was also to be expected, but it was a fact that we had to work around. The other thing about acquiring information, whether it had to do with staffing levels or budgets, is this. The information that we asked of the AOC was not often kept in a consistent, organized manner. The charts that you see at the end of the report detailing staffing levels and budget for each division, that information did not exist in the form that we have presented it to you. We've given that as a gift to AOC. That was our work. That information did not exist. It had to be extricated from the organization. And again, we make no judgment about whether or not it was withheld in any wrongful or purposeful manner. It just often did not exist in a consistent manner. Some of the answers, some of the responses that we received from AOC staff in response to our questions for information were simply non-responsive. People in our committee would joke sometimes at our committee meetings that if we were in court and we heard that answer and someone objected that the answer was non-responsive, all 12 of us would have sustained the objection. A question, for example, about whether or not a division used a cost-benefit analysis in trying to decide which programs to offer seems like a fairly straightforward question, but it often diverged into multiple emails, requests for clarifications, letters, correspondence, and at the end of the day, the answer was no. So this is the kind of tension, the kind of difficulty that we sometimes face, and again, not across the board, but it did happen. One of the tremendous advantages to our process is that a lot of the critical information regarding the operation and functions of the AOC came from the AOC itself. It came from the AOC division managers who were candid about the decision-making process, the operations, and functions of the AOC. I want to talk just a little bit about the perspective of our report. There is a natural tendency to say, well, this is a backward-looking report. We're looking back at things that have happened. We're looking back at staffing levels. We're looking back at what the budget was. But really, what the point, as far as we were concerned, for this committee was to develop a strategy. The name itself, Strategic Evaluation Committee, implies that we were trying to develop a strategy for the organization to move forward and succeed. The committee was asked to undertake a strategic evaluation of the Administrative Office of the Courts and to review its organization, including its organizational structure, management, processes, and size. Also stated in the report was that, consistent with the goals of transparency, accountability, and efficiency, the very intent of the report was to recommend an organizational structure that would better position the AOC for future success and which would be leaner, nimbler, and more responsive to the needs of the judicial branch and to the public. That's as forward-looking as you can get. That's the prism through which we looked at our assignment. One of the other things that was difficult as we moved along was the fact that there are changes occurring in the administrative office of the courts. We were not looking at a static organization. We started in May of 2011. Here we are a year later. Obviously, things were happening in the meantime. I'm sure Ms. Patel will tell you later in her presentation today what some of those changes are. But we did take into account the changes that have occurred since May 2011. The starting point of our task was what the AOC looked like when we started in May 2011. In the intervening months, the AOC made a number of changes, and it continues to make organizational changes. Events over the past year resulted in what we consider to be a slight contraction of the overall organizational structure. There was a combination of events, including the retirement of a former administrative director, resulting interim appointments to that position, departures of several division directors, the retirement of a regional office administrator, that led to some reorganization. We also noted that there were changes in the Executive Office Programs Division, that it was merged with another division which became known as CPAS, Court Programs and Services. Obviously, the CCMS Program Management Office was folded into the Information Services Division. The director of the Southern Regional Office retired, and that resulted in management responsibilities being transferred to another director. We also noted such changes as the Office of Communications and OERS, which were previously standalone offices within the AOC, being placed in the executive office in late 2011. And the council made a sea change with regard to its technology vision in March when it voted to stop the statewide deployment of CCMS as the statewide system for case management. All those were noted in our report. However, we still reviewed the divisions and functions that attached to those different divisions and parts of the organization. Not only did we talk about the changes that have occurred, we also made a judgment about whether or not that was a solid way to move forward or not. We characterized the AOC's change in the last year as inching towards consolidation in functions and not necessarily as one that came through a predetermined game plan. The organizational consolidations that occurred in the last year, many of which we feel resulted from extraneous events, retirements, attrition, that type of thing. I think that the AOC is moving towards the a predetermined game plan and structural reorganization, but I don't think that that has occurred yet. And our committee commented on that. That's our view. We also commented on changes in staffing levels that have occurred since May 2011. And I will tell you that determining the staffing levels at any point in the AOC's recent history was the most difficult thing that we tried to accomplish in our report. And again, that's because the information did not exist in a consistent, unified fashion. It had to be pulled, and many of the division directors had different understandings of what temporary employees were, what contract staff were, and the like. Those are talked about in our report. We found that as mentioned in the report, the AOC sustained tremendous growth as a result of the monumental changes that occurred to the organization starting back in the late 90s with the trial court unification and those types of events. And as of December, which we use as a benchmark in our report, we found that the total staffing positions were approximately 1,008. All of those numbers came from the AOC. Those were derived from the AOC. Those are self-reported numbers. We have no ability to count 1,008 people, but that's the information that was given to us. And we noted that that was a decrease of approximately 113 positions during the current fiscal year. We tried to make our report as current as we possibly could. Keep in mind, we turned our report in on May 24th. On May 11th, about 10 or 11 days before our report or so, we sent an email to the AOC and said, please tell us what your current staffing level is. They told us that as of April 30th, the staffing level at that point was still 983, which is in our view, not much of a drop from the 1,008 that existed at the end of the year. My personal belief, and I know that this is shared with other members of the committee, is that no one really knows how many people worked at the AOC in different capacities at various points in time. That's just the way it is in our view. That should change. It's a little unnerving to come here and sit before you for the first time and give a report and tell you that you need to do something. It's unnerving to tell you that our committee found that the Judicial Council has to exercise greater oversight. But because this was a top-to-bottom review of the AOC, necessarily the review starts at the top, and I'm looking at the top right now, which is the Judicial Council. And we made various findings about that. We feel that that is a critical part of this entire endeavor because the tone of the AOC, its mission, whether or not it's a service or control agency, and those types of things are determined in large part by the actions and oversight of the Judicial Council. We specifically recommend that the performance of the administrative director of the courts be reviewed on a very specific, regimented way. I'm not going to spend time going over the organizational structure. It's in the report, but I want to make just a couple of comments about it. What you see before you is the organizational structure of the AOC when our committee began its task. A picture tells a thousand stories in this case. This is a picture of an organization that is top-heavy. When we started, it had 17 separate direct reports to the administrative director, including various divisions, specialized offices, and regional offices. The difficulty in decision-making, whether it's fiscal processes or not, was rendered very difficult by the manner in which the organization was established. You know, in a trial, there's always a few phrases that stick out in your mind at the end of a case. And in talking to one of the divisional directors during the course of our interviews of the division directors, one of the things that stuck out in our mind was a characterization that went like this. The AOC has grown in its organization like a coral reef without a seeming function or shape. And this is what happened. This is where it ended up. So that's where we started. Our recommendation, which is simply that, a recommendation, was to streamline and reduce the number of divisions. And basically, if I could describe it in a sentence, to push down the organization, to make it less top-heavy, to make it more streamlined, to put it more in line with other organizations in state agencies and the like, which would include basically an operations side and an administrative side, and in this case also with the chief of staff, who would be charged with some of the policy legislative matters, and also to elevate trial court support and liaison services to make that at the top of the organizational chart. Someone else here, I think, already noted that we found it interesting that when we started, the organizational charts, and we received many that reflected the organization of the AOC over the years, never showed the Judicial Council at the top. That says a lot. It says a lot about Judicial Council oversight, but it also talks and speaks about the perspective or viewpoint of the organization itself, that it is an organization unto itself that has to change. Very briefly, in addition to analyzing the organizational structure, we took a hard look at some of the management systems and processes. And those are detailed in the report. I won't reiterate those. We found the decision-making process to be unclear. This information came from administrative managers, division directors, and high-level managers who were saying that to us. We found that the program and project planning and monitoring system needed improvement. that there was a lack of system-wide fiscal planning and processes and a lack of buy-in from courts on a number of important projects. The performance appraisals and personnel policies, that part of the organization is broken. We were surprised to learn that, with few exceptions, the divisions were not conducting and had not conducted a regular personnel evaluations of their employees, which is important for a number of reasons which are set forth in the report. Personnel policies were violated or ignored, one of the most noteworthy being the telecommute policy. And I want to, just as a side note right there, tell you that when we see these types of problems and identify them, it's hard not to do that without sounding overly critical or having a tone. But these are the facts. We also looked at the position classification system. We found that to be out of balance and not applied in a consistent manner. That is usually followed by some problems with the compensation system, which we noted. One of the more significant problems that we found was the fiscal processes. When we talked with the people that were running the finance division in charge of the financial policies in the organization, we found that they were frozen out. They didn't know what another part of the organization was doing. They didn't know how fiscal decisions were made. They were not involved at all levels of important projects. And I think we saw some of that with CCMS and other branch-wide initiatives. So we commented on that. We also talked about the grants process, and I somehow managed to leave off the PowerPoint, the rulemaking process. We think that there's room for improvements there. I want to tell you that one of the loudest, most vocal concerns we heard in the trial courts was complaints about the rulemaking process, the number of rules, the number of times that we heard that. You just shake your head after a while. And so when we got that type of information, what do you do with it? You look at it. You look at what is the current rulemaking process. Are there really a lot of rules, or is this just a perception? And we found that there really were a lot of rules that were being created. A lot of times that posed problems for trial courts which were not identified. Obviously, there's a tension when you establish a rule. You need uniform procedures. They accomplish good purposes, such as some of the speakers identified here before me, but they also pose a risk of operational difficulties to the courts, which were not always foreseen. So we made recommendations on that, too. We also looked at the AOC divisions. I'm not going to tell you all of the things that we found with those divisions. I will tell you that it was hard work and that we looked at each division separately. With the same perspective, we had the same focus. We wanted to find out what the division did and describe that for the readers. We wanted to describe what the staffing and budget resources were for the various divisions. We wanted also to identify what were the mandatory statutory activities and core functions of each division, because unless you do that, you can't tell whether or not they're performing non-essential functions, which is one of the criticisms that we were receiving up and down the state. We also identified what we found to be key issues and findings. We did not include all of our findings, all of the issues that we spotted with each division, only those that we found to be consistent, verifiable, and noteworthy. We made recommendations for improvement. In looking at the divisions, we did not accept a single anecdote of a complaining judge or a complaining court CEO about a problem with a particular division. We tried to identify patterns and problems that were reappearing. We also looked at the budget process. I told you we were blessed as a committee with a very high level of expertise and experience on our committee with the advisory members that were there to guide us. They found that there's a big problem with the transparency in the budget. I know that steps are being taken to fix that, and that's one of the things that has to happen before the AOC starts to regain credibility with its budget process. We made specific recommendations regarding tracking systems, information displays, and tracking appropriations and expenditures so members of the public, members of the judicial branch, and others can look at the AOC budget, can look at the judicial branch budget, and make an apples-to-apples comparison of one year to another. On staffing levels, again, we didn't start with the preconceived notion that the AOC was too big or that it had too many people. I shared with you some of the comments that we received and some of the perceptions that were widely shared perceptions among the judicial branch, but we set about trying to find out what the staffing level was. We noted that it was difficult to obtain consistent, complete data on staffing levels, partly, as I said before, because neither the HR division nor any other AOC division regularly maintained complete information about that. That was the hardest area to get data. None of the charts in the appendix, as I mentioned, existed before. And I would say this, too, that if the report is viewed as a snapshot in time, as to staffing levels, I would tell you that if it is a snapshot, it contains a panoramic view. It looks at 10 years or so of what the staffing levels were, what the budgeting levels were for the various divisions and the AOC as a whole. We made a recommendation that was limited, in my view, and by the committee, based on the information that we had. We did not have workload studies that would tell us whether or not there should be three employees in a division unit instead of two or four. We didn't have that information. But we did have what I think is also better information than a metric or a piece of data, and that is we had the conversations, candid admissions of many of the directors and managers within the AOC who said, look, there's too many people here. We don't need that unit. We have too many people there, or one unit talking about another, and it helped focus our examination of those issues. We think that whatever the staffing level is at the AOC, it must be made more transparent and understandable. It needs to be, as with the budget information, something that anyone can look at. We made some suggestions about that. I think that the state budget situation is outstripping the recommendations that we made in terms of staff size. What the budget crisis is forcing the AOC to do is what probably should have been happening all along, which is this: to examine your most critical, essential functions that serve the trial courts and the public, and to put your resources there. You have to make some hard decisions about some of the functions that are not essential given limited resources. Our proposal on staffing levels was really modest. We simply said, don't exceed the number of authorized positions that the legislature gives you. That's where 880 came from. That's in the governor's budget. We suggest that after that a reorganization of the AOC with efficiencies and some of the other recommendations that we're making would result in a much smaller organization. And we took our best stab at that. The final thing I'd like to say is this. People wonder whether or not the SEC report is a landmark document or it's a blueprint for the future and a number of other things. And I think the answer is we don't know. It could be, or it might not. That depends on what you want to do with your power as members of the Judicial Council to move the branch forward and to take a look at the organization as we see it. If I was critiquing the report in hindsight, and judges need to be accountable, I would say that we did not properly emphasize the strength of the services provided to the appellate courts by the AOC. By definition, though, as I tried to say earlier, our focus was on the problems that we were seeing, not necessarily on the positives. And to the extent that we didn't emphasize that particular strength, I give myself a demerit and our committee a demerit. That was not intended. Our focus was on the trial courts, which is really where the bulk of the criticisms and concerns were coming from. In 2006, the Judicial Council was given a consultant report by KPMG, which contained many recommendations. It recommended such things as having a chief operating officer. It made changes and recommendations regarding the administrative infrastructure of the AOC. It made recommendations regarding the statewide technology initiative known as CCMS at that time. It recommended that there be a business case analysis. It recommended a number of things. It critiqued the Office of General Counsel. It did a number of things, and that report gathered dust. And so, to be blunt, our concern is that many of the recommendations that we're stating have been stated previously, and that we hope that they are not only considered, but that some of them are implemented. That would conclude my comments, Judge McCabe.
I'll keep mine brief, noting that Judge Walkup addressed the bulk of what we wanted to present to the council. So first, Chief Counsel and members of the public, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Briefly, our mission was to do an in-depth review, and I think the SEC accomplished that mission. Two, our purpose was also to initiate discussion. I think we succeeded in that area as well. Our report, its tone, its objectivity, was not meant to be a feel-good report. And we had discussions about this. We had discussions from everything about how long the report should be, 50 pages, to everything we want in it, 800 pages. And so the committee had to draw a line on accomplishing our mission in somewhat of a reasonable fashion and using the resources that we had, remembering that we didn't have staff. Those charts, I now know how to build charts with the best of them, and I can build charts quick. And it was a fascinating process, but we did the best we could with the resources that we had. We do not profess that this is the blueprint for the future. It's a tool that we hope each of you will analyze in moving forward. It's not meant to be take everything or leave it. It's to initiate the thinking process, the discussion process, and we hope that our point of view in the end is some semblance of what should be done, but we're not perfect. It's an imperfect process in an imperfect world. So it's there for you to consider. I want to start there. Number two, next, our intent is not to restrict or tie the hands of the new ADOC. When they come in, whoever that individual is, it's got to have some freedom to implement their vision. And so we don't want this report to be viewed as when you get the job, this is what you have to do. Again, it's a tool, and tools is whatever you want to make of it. It really appears to me, and I'm going to keep this short, that it's based on perspective. If you have a perspective about a certain role or the AOC and how it interacts with you, how it helps you, you have to remind yourself that that may influence your perspective. How do I know that? Because we struggled with that for months. Sat around the table, bickering and arguing with each other, and it was a family atmosphere. And I have kind of brothers and sisters that we've had some drag-out arguments. But in the end of the day, not personal, wouldn't have a cup of coffee or wine or two. And we kept it in perspective. And so it took us a long time, trained professionals, to remove that influence, every one of us. And there is a knee-jerk reaction. And I've sat here, and I hope I'm not disrespectful to anybody if I'm grinning, because I'm hearing what we've already lived through and we've already struggled with. Like, wow, they're going through the same thing we went through. Except we had 55 weeks to do this. So in closing, I hope that you receive it for what it is. It's a constructive criticism of issues affecting AOC. We've already identified the essential role of the AOC in the branch, and I think our report is very clear on that, that they are a necessary component. There are a lot of hard-working, quality employees at the AOC. And no apologies for not going into that in the report, but I will put that out there as a side note. And I speak on behalf of the committee, and our chair has emphasized that point as well, is there are a lot of folks here that should be proud of their work. But this is about figuring out what our core and essential functions are versus aspirational. And we'd love to do a lot of things. And we had those discussions over months. And we 180 degree. I mean, it was one against some, and then it was five. It was almost like the movie 12 Angry Men. And it starts out one, then it builds, because it was a process. I welcome the Judicial Council reviewing this report. I welcome the opportunity to have the three members that are now on the Judicial Council being a part of that as advisory members. We're here to serve, we're here to help, and we're here to provide whatever input we can to clarify what we did so that you have a better understanding, and then you can make an informed decision. So with that, thank you very much, and are there any questions?
Well, before we begin the question period, I first want to thank Judge Walkup and Judge McCabe for the illuminating presentation of behind the scenes. It's very helpful, and I think it answers a lot of questions and helps us understand, I think, the bonding and the pain, quite frankly. But what I'd like to do is field questions after we hear how the report will proceed, because I think questions and process are going to merge, and I don't want to artificially distinguish between questions or comments people may have, and I don't think what Justice Miller wants to say about process will take that long, and then we'll proceed to public comment, or maybe a short break, and then a comment. I see heads nodding.
Who am I to argue with the chief? Whatever you would like.